We're now going to turn to our reading, which is Revelation chapter 3, verses 7 to 13.
7 to 13. Praise the Lord. To the angel of the church in Philadelphia. These are the words of him who is holy and true, who holds the key of David. What he opens, no one can shut, and what he shuts, no one can open. I know your deeds. See, I have placed before you an open door that no one can shut. I know that you have little strength, yet you have kept my word and have not denied my name. I will make those who are of the synagogue of Satan, who claim to be Jews, though they are not, but are liars. I will make them come and fall down at your feet and acknowledge that I have loved you. Since you have kept my commandment to endure, patiently, I will also keep you from the hour of trial that is going to come upon the whole world to test those who live on the earth. I am coming soon. Hold on to what you have, so that no one will take your crown. Him who overcome, I will make a pillar in the temple of my God. Never again will he leave it. I will write on him the name of my God and the name of the city of my God, the New Jerusalem, which is coming down out of heaven from my God. I will also write on him my new name. 13 and last. He who has an ear, let him hear what the Spirit says to the churches. Here's the reading of the Lord. Amen.
Good morning. That was pants. Good morning. Thank you. We all have a longing deep within who we are for stability and for security and for certainty. And these are things that we spend our lives often running after. I know that's been the case in my life. But for so many people in the world, as we were powerfully reminded in our prayers just now, these three things are just not an option. However, this morning I want to unpack the uncertainty factor, which is a reality that while we live in a stable society and while we seem to be better off than many people in the world, these things aren't certain for us either. All of us live in the midst of uncertainty in one way or another. And yet the desire for stability, for security and certainty lies strongly within us. Let me unpack that a little bit. Of course, recently we had a general election, and I'm not making a statement on what party you should have voted for or anything like that. That's for you to decide. But one thing that really caught my attention was the emphasis on the one side that you want stability, that you want strength. If you want things to carry on, if you want certainty in your life, then vote this way. We can promise you that we'll be strong. We can promise you that we'll protect your assets. We can promise you this, that, and the other. If you want certainty, vote for us. And then on the other side, there was a promise also around certainty. Do you want your NHS protected? Do you want us to invest in education? Do you care about the poor and want to offer them security? Do these things matter to you? Then vote for us. We'll offer you certainty in these things. We'll put money into these things. Now, I'm not saying whether those things are right or wrong, but I find the underlying narrative fascinating, that there is something within us which advertising gurus and politicians recognise, cries out for this degree of stability, of security, and of certainty. This stretches out into every area of our lives. And I know there's one thing I'll probably or possibly never be able to do, which I'm told is a key feature of my life. And it is currently lacking, and I doubt it will ever be solved. And it is this. I should buy a property. Now, this is out of reach for me. It might be out of reach for you, or you might be a homeowner. But again, the interesting thing isn't whether you're a homeowner or not. The interesting thing is we live in a culture that says, if you want security and stability and certainty, then own your own piece of land. Own your own castle if you're an Englishman. For that will make you secure and strong against the attacks of the opposing armies that are bound to come across your moat any day now. There is something solid in bricks and mortar which is deeply, deeply appealing, as is the fact that we're all told that we should save and make sure we should have pensions and invest in the right stocks and shares and all these things, if you do it wisely, will give you a degree of certainty and stability in your future. Now, there's nothing wrong with any of these things. There's nothing wrong with investing wisely or having a pension or owning a home or investing in the health service or even having strong and stable leadership at the top of government so we can arrange things and structure things well. But my point is that all these things are an illusion. All these things can disappear. And if we put our hope and faith in our certainty being any of these, then we're going to be sadly misguided. Our investments can all go to pot. Things can go wrong with property, and one day property prices may crash. It seems unlikely at the moment in London, I have to say. But shortly before my dad became a vicar, he bought a cottage down in Devon, a nice little place, with the thought that that means at least they'll be on the housing ladder, so when they retire, they can have a nice little place to go to. And shortly after he became a vicar, he lost the whole thing to dry rot and all the money that he tied up in it, which on the one hand was slightly frustrating. But on the other hand, he said, well, we've trusted God to this point. We're not going to worry about these things. But even bricks and mortar can disappear. However much we invest in the health service, at some point, all of us are going to get sick and all of us are going to die. This is a reality that hangs over us. And no matter whether we've BUPA or not, actually, sickness will catch up with us in one way or another. And it will affect those we love. There is no certainty in this. And as for strong and stable leadership, we can probably skip over that one for now. We can convince ourselves in our society in this day and age that we are relatively secure, that we have a degree of certainty. However much this might be an illusion, we can cling on to it. However, clinging on to any kind of certainty wasn't an option for the people in the city who are being addressed today, the people of a place called Philadelphia. Now, the people of Philadelphia lived in modern-day Turkey, and they just happened to live at the centre point of the earthquake zone in that part of the world. And so if you look at a picture of where the ruins of Philadelphia would be today, you can't see a huge amount. I don't think the sheep are original artefacts. I assume they've been brought in later on. You can see some ruins in the distance, but they're not from when the city of Philadelphia that we're looking at today are from. They're from a later building, because this area was racked again and again by violent earthquakes. Clinging on to certainty when your house might fall down any day isn't a particularly easy thing to do. Strabo, who had a brilliant beard, interestingly enough, very hipster for his day, he was a Greek geographer and historian, and he travelled all around this region of the Roman Asia Minor. And he, after visiting this area, he noted that the city of Philadelphia was ever subject to earthquakes. Incessantly, the walls of the houses are cracked, different parts of the city being thus affected at different times. I don't think he worked for the Philadelphia Tourist Board, because he then went on to say this: Philadelphia has no trustworthy walls, but daily in one direction or another, they keep tottering and falling apart. This isn't a place where any kind of security can be clung into in bricks and mortar. But the problems for the Philadelphians wasn't just the physical fact that their homes could come crashing down around them quite literally any moment. They also had an issue with the economy. For because they lived in a volcanic, a volatile region, it meant they had really good soil for certain things. And one of the things they were particularly good at around Philadelphia was producing this. Wine. Some of you might be a big fan, some of you might have heard of it. But that was the main thing they produced in the area. In fact, the area today is still famous for its raisins and sultanas. This great grape-growing territory. But there was a bit of an issue in the Roman empire. It wasn't an issue as far as I was concerned, but certain people in power saw it so. Because in the provinces of the Roman Empire, there were so many people growing grapes, the crop, and producing wine, that there was a massive surplus. And so wine prices were coming crashing down. Never a good thing if all your money's tied up in one industry. But there was a chap at the top who was about to make things even worse. This not particularly nice-looking fellow is the Emperor Domitian, who was in power from 81 to 96 AD. And he was a rather authoritarian Roman ruler. He wasn't very well liked, and he wasn't one of the good ones by any stretch of the imagination. And he used his rule to try and take away as much power as he could from the, largely speaking, democratic Senate. And so here you have a dictator in charge. Now, what Domitian decided to do was, because wine prices were crashing, because him and all his friends were owners of large estates in Italy, where they produced lots of wine and made lots of money, he decided to do something about this. So he declared that anywhere outside of Italy, outside the direct area of Rome, anyone who owned a vineyard had to get rid of 50% of their crops. They just had to burn it and get rid of the land. So his idea, of course, you get rid of 50% of the stuff, then prices will increase rapidly for the local landed elite in Italy. Now, I know to you or I, the idea of a leader of a rich and powerful nation blaming issues in the economy on cheap foreign imports is mind-boggling. Surely it's difficult for us to comprehend. But that's exactly what Domitian did. And so the threat was hanging over Philadelphia, not just the threat of earthquakes, which could rack them any day, but also the fact that the very thing they've built their life on to this point, the thing that means they're, even though they're in dodgy, tottering down houses, that means they have some degree of financial stability, is at real risk. And this was all happening just before John penned the book of Revelation. This is the backdrop. This is the scene. This is the uncertainty which is hanging over and should be crippling the church in Philadelphia. In the end, Domitian had to perform an embarrassing U-turn, as no politician likes to do, because making wine more expensive turned out to be radically unpopular. I don't know why. So in the end, he went back on his policy. But still, that is the backdrop for the church in Philadelphia. At any day now, both their houses, their lives could come tumbling down, and the finances that they mean they can have a living could come crashing down around them as well. The letter, the message sent to the church in Philadelphia, which is presented to them, it takes all of this into account. Here we have a message written to those who are in the midst of uncertain times. Uncertainty was a reality for them. And if we're totally honest with ourselves, looking around us at the news going on this week, and if we look around our own situations, I think perhaps it's more clear than it has been for a long time for us in the relatively safe West, that uncertainty is a reality for our lives as well. And so the message to the church in Philadelphia is very much a message for us. So how are they doing in the midst of all this uncertainty? Are they falling apart? Are they stressing out? Are they turning their backs on God? Well, no, actually. John writes his message to them. And he actually says, you guys, you're doing okay. You're doing a good job. In spite of everything falling down around you, you are persevering. You are keeping going. And then he goes on to unpack the following three things, which is going to be our message to the message to us this morning. Firstly, he emphasised, guys, you're doing a good job. You're doing okay. You're persevering despite of all the challenges that are coming your way. Secondly, he encourages them to keep going. They should keep going and not be taken in by others. They need to carry on with their God-given mission and trust that he will make a way for them against all the odds. And thirdly and finally, he gives them a promise. One day, at the final day, there will be certainty for the church in Philadelphia. There will be peace and there will be eternal hope. And they need to hold on to this in the midst of whatever may come their way. So he says, good job. He says, keep going. And he gives them a promise. Let's unpack that a bit more now. So firstly, John writes to the church there. The message he has given miraculously for them was a good job. He says in verse 8, I know your deeds. See, I have placed before you an open door that no one can shut. I know that you have little strength, yet you have kept my word and not denied my name. Here is a church that in the face of uncertainty, they have kept going. They have kept going. And for some of you this morning, you all have been through pretty torrid times. You may have been affected by sickness, or you may have lost someone you loved. You may be under severe financial pressure. You may be really shaken up by what's going on in the world. There may be all sorts of stresses and strains and uncertainty surrounding your life. And what God wants to say to you is the same that he wanted to say to the church in Philadelphia. I know you may have little strength, and yet I see what you're going through. I see you and I love you. And I'm pleased that you've kept going. Well done, good and faithful servants. If you've kept going in the midst of uncertainty, God isn't blind to it. He sees you and he is with you, whether or not that's obvious to you at the time. But that's not the end of the saying, kind of, well done and get on with it. He also says to them, I've given you an open door that no one else can shut. That no one else can shut. And this is the most amazing church, most amazing truth for the church in Philadelphia. Here is a church which is battered and bruised, who are under financial pressures, who have insecurity under every point in their lives. And yet the message to them is, well done. You're doing okay. You're doing a good job. And more than that, if you carry on serving me faithfully, I am the one who will open doors for you. And the experience of my life and the experience of countless others is if you are faithful and if you fulfill the mission that God has given you and you alone to do, he is the one who will open the doors. It matters not how impossible things may seem. If God has given you something to get on with in your life, he is the one who will make a way. It's not that you're going to try and do it through your own security and clever investment and your use of time and your energies, though all those things God might put to use. It is God who will make a way for you. Well done. You're doing a good job. Trust him. Seek his voice. And he will open the door for you. What an amazing promise. So firstly, you guys are doing a good job. Secondly, he says, keep on going. Keep on going. In verses 9 to 11, some of the issues that the church might face over the coming years are tackled. But it ends with this incredible promise. I am coming soon. Hold on to what you have so that no one can take your crown. Hold on to what you have so that no one can take your crown. No matter what you've been through so far, keep going. Run the race. There are going to be challenges ahead, but God is with you. So what were the specific challenges which were on the horizon for the church in Philadelphia? Now, this is a slightly odd one for us. So we'll read through verses 9 to 11. John writes, I will make those who are of the synagogue of Satan, who claim to be Jews, though they are not, but are liars. I will make them come and fall down at your feet and acknowledge that I have loved you. Since you have kept my commandments to endure patiently, I will also keep you from the hour of trial that is going to come on the whole world to test the inhabitants of the earth. Now that's a slightly weird paragraph by any stretch of the imagination, as you'll have been unpacking lots of Revelation is. But here is some really key imagery which we can dive into it to unpack what was going on. For the message to the church in Philadelphia was they were to keep going, and they were to keep going in the midst of various challenges. Now, the challenge they were going to face was to do with this idea of the synagogue of Satan. What on earth is going on there? What on earth did he mean? Well, if we skip forward 15 years after the Revelation was written, we come to a chap called Ignatius of Antioch, who was on his way to his eventual martyrdom as he was murdered by the Roman authorities in Rome. But on the way, he wrote various letters, and one of the letters he wrote was to the Church of Philadelphia. And he had this peculiar paragraph to say to the church in Philadelphia. He says, But if any man preach unto you Judaism, hearken not unto him. For it is better to hear Christianity from one circumcised than Judaism from one uncircumcised. Now that may not clear things up for us, one iota or one jot, but we can get the impression that what was going on in Philadelphia was things had become a bit confused, that there were non-Jews who were preaching Judaism and trying to persuade Christians to live according to the law, and there were Christians who were confused with Jews and Jews who were confused with Christians, and things had got a bit muddled. So John writes to a church which is confused and which is surrounded by people who are trying to pull them back into the old way of doing things, and the message to them is to keep going and to stand out and to be willing to be different from the prevailing culture around them. It's a bit like this. They were surrounded by one mentality, by one concept, that the old and they were told they had to stand out and be different. And the thing they had to not fall into the trap of following was this. This is the temple that stood at the heart of Judaism. This is where Jesus went up and did much of his teaching, and where the religious authorities eventually decided to kill him. This lay at the heart of Jewish worship in one form or another for centuries. And it represented the old way of things, that this was the only way you could connect with God, that here and here alone lay God's presence in a special way, that you had to do the whole sacrificial system, that you had to get circumcised, that you had to fulfill all the laws if you were going to come into the presence of God. And all that structure, all that clarity was deeply appealing to people in the pagan heart of the Roman Empire. And so the church found itself getting sucked into the old way of seeing things. Now, for most of us, the idea that we're going to get sucked into doing things according to the temple system, that we're going to start sacrificing goats and go and get circumcised and all these things, probably isn't on our agenda, though I see a few wry smiles. It's your own business, quite frankly. So that's, for us, clearly isn't an issue. But what lies at the heart of that absolutely is. For we have a prevailing culture around us, which we take on and we absorb without even thinking or questioning. And for us, it isn't the rigidity of the Jewish law legal system. For us, it's the prevailing culture of living in London in the 21st century. And there are all sorts of views around sex, around money, around politics, around the way we treat people, which are so ingrained into our media and into our society that we absorb them without even questioning them. And so the message to the church in Philadelphia is the message to us. Don't get so absorbed by your surrounding culture that you fail to question it. Don't be so absorbed by the world's way of doing things that you miss out on the fact I've called you to be distinctive. Be different. Run the race. Keep on going. Keep on going. So they've been told you're doing a good job. They've been told that they need to keep going. And finally, they're given the most amazing promise. Now, for a people who are always on the edge of uncertainty, always on the edge of physical collapse, always on the edge of persecution, and always on the edge of financial ruin, the promise which was given to them must have been like receiving cool water in the middle of the desert. For they promised that one day, they'll be able to stand still in certainty at last. They're promised that one day the new Jerusalem will come, which is an image which will recur again and again throughout Revelation. A promise that one day God will come and be with his people. The promise that one day we'll live with God's presence in our midst. That one day there'll be no more tears and no more suffering. There'll be no more sin and no more injustice. There'll be no more hatred and no more war. We will have certainty at last. And for a people whose buildings were crumbling around them, they're given this incredible promise in verse 12. The one who is victorious, I will make a pillar in the temple of my God. Never again will they leave it. I will write on them the name of my God and the name of the city of my God, the New Jerusalem, which is coming down out of heaven from my God. And I will also write to them my new name. At the heart of Christianity lies the promise that death is not the end. Jesus met it in the cross and showed there was life afterwards. It's at the very heart of our being, this promise that one day we will be with God. We'll be there with him, with his presence surrounding us, and all will be well. All will be well. All manner of things will be well, to quote Julian of Norwich. What an amazing day that will be. And yet, sir, how easy it is for us to lose sight of that promise. How easy it is for us to get so absorbed with the worries and fears of this life, or with trying to make this world a better place, that we can miss out on the fact that one day all will be well. Does that mean that we're not to engage in the world around us, and we're to quickly fly through death and fly through life and arrive at death safely and then be with God? No. The opposite is true, and it always has been. C.S. Lewis, the brilliant academic and armchair theologian, once observed this. If you read history, you will find that the Christians who did most for the present world were precisely those who thought most about the next. It is since Christians have largely ceased to think about the other world that they have become so ineffective in this. The Christians who did most for the present world were precisely those who thought most about the next. We have certainty. We have security. We have a strong and certain promise. We don't need to fear death. We don't need to fear ruin. We don't need to fear persecution. We don't need to fear our houses falling down. Yes, those things are difficult. Yes, those things hurt. Yes, those things are difficult. And God never said that following him was going to be easy. He never said that he'd take away uncertainty from the midst of our lives. But he promised two things. He promised that he would always be with us to the very end of the age. And he promised that one day everything will be well. All will be well. All will be well. All manner of things will be well. And if we lived our lives like this was the reality, then I wonder how radically different, how much radical confidence we could live our lives with. Not from a place of insecurity and fear, but from a place of knowing that our souls are already safe in his hands. And so we're going to respond in these three ways this morning. I'm going to ask the band to come up and begin getting themselves ready. But there are three ways which I'd like you to respond. The first of these is some of you have been through a rubbish time. Some of you have had just stuff going on and things feel so uncertain and it feels so unfair. And yet you've kept going and you've kept trusting. And for you guys, I just want you to sit where you are and to maybe put your hands out in front of you and to spend time listening to the words of this song and to remember that God is with you and he sees what you go through and he loves you and his presence will never leave you. So that's the first way to respond. The second way to respond is for some of you, you realised that you need to listen to that promise again, or you need to listen to that command to keep going, to get the crown which is awaiting you. And some of you will realise that you've begun to absorb more from the world around you than you're absorbing from God and his word. You've begun to take more of the hopelessness and the uncertainty of this world, and you've begun to believe the lies of the evil one, that that's the way of doing things. And if you need God's help going forward, if you want to say, today, I want to press on, I want to move forward, I want God's help with the uncertainty of my life, whether that uncertainty is sickness or death or financial uncertainty or anything else, then I'd love you to get up where you are and to head to this corner and the prayer team be waiting for you. And there's something so powerful about physically getting up and moving to a different space to receive God's promise and to receive prayer. I'd really urge you, if that in any way touches on your life, to go and do that. And finally, some of you need to hear you're doing a good job. Some of you need to be spurred on and to receive prayer to keep going. And finally, some of you just need to know that there is a promise that one day all will be well. And if you're not responding to the first two things, what I'd like you to do at some point in the next couple of songs, I'd like you to get up from where you are and to go and see Nesta at the back of church. And she has loads of sheets with Revelation chapter 3, verse 12 on it, talking about being a pillar in God's temple. And I'd like you, as part of your worship, to go to smile nicely at Nesta, to receive one of these. And then this week, put it on your fridge, put it in your loo, put it by your bed, put it somewhere where you'll see it. And each morning, look at it and remember that whatever you do that day, We do it in the light that the fact that one day all will be well, that we'll be confident, we can be confident that we've got eternity before us with God. And one day, all will be well. All will be well. All manner of things will be well. I leave you to respond how you see fit.